This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The U.S. announces some more sanctions aimed squarely at Vladimir Putin's inner circle. The high school graduation rate climbs to 80%. And Donald Sterling, what the future holds for the owner of the L.A. Clippers. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, April 28th, and it's great to have you with us. New U.S. sanctions target 17 Russian companies and 7 individuals. Among them is the head of Russia's largest oil company. But the effects of sanctions aren't so neatly contained. They could affect U.S. firms and multinationals with ties to those Russian companies and individuals. For starters, BP's stock was down about 1% this afternoon. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
One of the people targeted by the U.S. sanctions, the head of the Russian oil giant Rosneft. BP owns almost 20% of Rosneft.
That is significant.
That's Nicholas Spiro, managing director of Spiro Sovereign Strategy. He says BP may have the most at stake in Russia, but it's the best prepared. It has years of experience in Russia.
It saw this coming. It certainly saw these sanctions coming a mile off.
In a statement, BP says it's committed to its investment in Rosneft, but will comply with any relevant sanctions. And if those sanctions really start to bite, will Moscow take a whack at BP or Exxon? Stephen Shork of the Shork Report says no, because Russia and big oil need each other.
Western oil companies and Russia are in bed together, and they are strange bedfellows, but they are dependent on one another.
In fact, Exxon and Rosneft plan a joint drilling operation in the Arctic Sea, but it's a delicate balance. Fadel Gate is a senior energy analyst at Oppenheimer. He says if the tensions over sanctions caused just a 6-month delay, there would be major consequences for Arctic exploration because the drilling season is very short up there.
So basically, you're talking about a couple of months in the summer, and that's it. You know, September would be too late.
If you miss the window, you have to wait another year. That doesn't appear to be a danger now, but Fadel Gates says the West does have more power in its sanctions arsenal. If it got really mad, it could impose Iranian-style sanctions. It's virtually cut off Iran's oil exports to the West. And today, senior Obama administration officials said several times they could ratchet things up in Russia. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Kai talked to Treasury Secretary Jack Lew on the show last week. He had some pretty interesting things to say about sanctions, and you can hear the whole thing at marketplace.org. Donald Sterling, the owner of the L.A. Clippers, allegedly made some pretty ugly racist remarks that were caught on tape and released over the weekend. Those remarks are getting plenty of well-deserved criticism, and his team is getting hit, too. They're losing sponsors, including 2 big ones, CarMax and Virgin America. State Farm says it's, quote, taking a pause in our relationship with the organization. What's not clear yet is how Sterling will be punished if the offensive recordings are authenticated. As someone who owns an NBA franchise, Sterling is part of a club of very rich men, and yes, they are almost all men, who wield a lot of influence over the NBA's new commissioner. His name is Adam Silver, and he is responsible for conducting the investigation. Marketplace's Noel King has that story.
NBA teams are franchises, but unlike, say, a McDonald's franchise, where corporate headquarters holds most of the power, here the power is held by the franchisees. Jill Pilgrim is a sports attorney.
The owners, they're like the members of a club. They're a club to have a common business interest in the development of sport, but also revenue generation.
The NBA's bylaws and constitution are secret, but Pilgrim says there's probably a morals provision that forbids an owner from doing anything that might hurt revenue.
There is no doubt, however that provision is worded, that this instance has definitely hurt the brand of the NBA.
Because of the secrecy, we can only guess what Sterling's punishment might be. Michael McCann directs the Sports and Entertainment Law Institute at the University of New Hampshire School of Law.
We know that the lowest level penalty would be a fine, and a fine would likely be $500,000 or $1 million. That would be a significant move for many, but Donald Sterling is worth reportedly $1.9 billion.
Because the owners appoint the commissioner, the guy charged with conducting the investigation and handing down punishment, there's a question about just how independent he can be. Gabe Feldman directs the sports law program at Tulane Law School. He says the current NBA owners have made huge financial investments in their teams, and some of them may be torn over how to punish Sterling.
Each of the individual owners is concerned about having that investment taken from them. Even if the other 29 owners here are unhappy with what Donald Sterling said and how it impacts the value potentially of their franchise, they don't want down the road someone to turn around and say, well, we don't like what you said, so we're going to take your franchise from you.
The NBA Commissioner Adam Silver has said he hopes to have the investigation wrapped up in the next few days. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, some happy music and some not so happy music. Details when we do the numbers. When a power plant burns coal, the stuff that's left over is called coal ash. It was in the headlines a couple of months ago when a pond full of the stuff poured into the Dan River in North Carolina. That incident brought national scrutiny to what sounds like a nasty and huge source of toxic waste. Well, that same week, the Environmental Protection Agency announced that it 100% approved of using coal ash to make concrete. And it turns out many environmentalists agree. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has the story.
Steve Fleming is showing me his concrete plant. He's technical director for Prairie Materials, based in Chicago's southwest suburbs.
You can see the silos where we keep the cement, slag, fly ash.
Mentioned fly ash. That's coal fly ash. Like other companies, Prairie Materials uses fly ash to replace part of the cement in its concrete, 100,000 tons of it a year. Later, in his office, Fleming explains why.
We add it to our concrete to help with the performance, both when it's in its plastic state.
That is, when it's wet. Fly ash makes wet concrete easier to work with.
And more importantly, from my point of view, it helps the long-term performance of the concrete as well.
As an engineer, Fleming has always appreciated coal ash's benefits. It took customers longer.
When I first started 18, 19 years ago, I had a lot of customers who thought that fly ash was not good, that it was a waste product, and that, you know, why are you putting it in my concrete? Now we have contractors who are requesting fly ash. If we ship them a straight cement mix, they'll complain.
There are environmental advantages, too. Coal ash has toxins in it. Arsenic, lead, mercury. Locking that stuff up in concrete seems safer than letting it sit in landfills or ponds that can contaminate groundwater. The EPA endorsed using coal ash in concrete after comparing it to the toxins in Portland cement. Turns out, Portland cement is more toxic. Portland cement is also much worse for the environment. Craig Benson teaches environmental engineering at the University of Wisconsin.
Portland cement production is one of the major greenhouse gas sources worldwide.
He explains, to make Portland cement, you heat up limestone, which is made of calcium, oxygen, and carbon, to get lime, calcium, and oxygen.
Now that process liberates a lot of carbon dioxide that goes right up into the atmosphere.
Also, when you use coal ash, you're not using resources to dig up limestone or burning fuel to heat it up. And because fly ash makes concrete last longer, you're not replacing the concrete as often, all of which means you're also saving money. Benson did a study on that.
It was really remarkable. Just the economic impact is about $5 billion.
Lisa Evans is a lawyer for Earth Justice. She is reluctant to declare herself a fan of using coal ash for concrete. She'd rather we stop burning coal. Failing that...
Yeah, I mean, I think that characterizing it as a win would be accurate. If you're going to make coal ash in the first place, locking up in concrete is preferable to a lot of other ways that we either use or dispose of coal ash.
But the consensus isn't perfect. The EPA is currently deciding between two alternatives for regulating coal ash. Evans favors one that would regulate coal ash as hazardous waste, except for designated beneficial reuses, like concrete. But that proposal worries John Ward, a spokesman for the coal ash recycling industry. He thinks the exception would just cause confusion.
How can you call something hazardous on the property of the people who made it and expect you to want to put it in your house?
He thinks that potential confusion could make utilities reluctant to allow recyclers to take coal ash at all. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Your company ID badge were a tracking device, and your boss wanted you and your colleagues to wear it at all times for at least 2 weeks. Here's the sales pitch. Your badge would collect data constantly, and that data, well, it could benefit you and the whole company. Sociometric Solutions does this. They've developed the technology, and so far they say they've had a 90% participation rate in every rollout they've done. We have the president and CEO of Sociometric Solutions with us. His name is Ben Weber. And Ben, it's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
Tell me, first of all, just about your company. What do you guys do?
So at Sociometric Solutions, what we do is use sensing technology to understand how people interact and collaborate at work. What we're trying to do is really quantify, I think, what people have always felt to be unquantifiable. Things like, how are people interacting with each other? You know, how do you talk to customers? How engaged are you in a conversation? And how is information flowing in an organization?
So the means by which you do that is through this badge, this sociometric badge. Describe it for me. What can it do?
The sociometric badge, you can really think of as a replacement for a company ID badge. You know, if you think about the ID badge that you bring into work every day, it might have a little RFID chip. And that's the little chip that when you touch your ID to a door, lets you in. What we've done is add a number of additional sensors to these ID badges, specifically microphones, which don't record what you say, but in real time are doing voice processing, Bluetooth and other proximity sensors, which enable us to figure out where you are and who you're close with. Importantly, this individual data is not shared with a company, and we do this at an opt-in basis. You get feedback on your own behavior, and the company gets to see statistics about what's happening across the company and how these behaviors relate to different outcomes like productivity and turnover.
You stress the importance of interaction, and I wonder why that's so important to productivity.
Well, I think about it this way. I mean, the whole reason we're in companies is because together we can do something that we couldn't do by ourselves. You know, I could hire 100 brilliant people, and if I lock them in a broom closet for a month, they're actually not going to come up with too many good ideas. I think we've forgotten that, especially, again, in this country, whereas in a lot of other countries, they still value collaboration a lot more than we do here. Universally, the most powerful features, the behaviors that most predict performance and job satisfaction, are your interactions with the people you work with.
I'm going to guess that you've heard from critics who have said, that this is somehow reductive, that you're treating a worker as a worker and, you know, perhaps ignoring that person's individuality. Do you hear that criticism, and what would you say to it?
I understand where they're coming from, certainly. And I guess what I would say is that really what we're trying to do is provide people and companies with the tools to really understand how we should work with each other and really giving people the tools to say, you know what, this is actually really valuable use of my time. But when you think about areas like retail, I think one reason that people have been very interested is that a lot of times you're paid on commission. And what we can do is we can say, you know, here's what the best people do. You know, people who have three times as much sales as everybody else, here's how they talk to customers. And actually give you pointers, automated pointers. Like, if you talk to customers 10% more, you'll make, 20% more in commissions.
Are there takeaways that sort of apply to all of these places, things that companies could do to boost productivity?
Yeah, I think there's some broad tips. I mean, especially when you look at, anything from blue-collar work to white-collar work. Taking breaks with colleagues, whether that's a coffee break, eating lunch with them, is beneficial for you and for the company as a whole. And I wouldn't say that all of this is news to people, but it's just now I can actually tell you how much this is worth.
Ben Weber, the head of the company's Sociometric Solutions. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you very much.
Dove tells consumers the secret to being beautiful is in a package.
There's nothing in the beauty patch.
Nothing.
When a marketing campaign backfires, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average climbed 87 points, 0.5%, to close at 16,448. The NASDAQ fell 1 point, basically flat, to end the day at 4074. The S&P 500 rose 6 points, 0.3%, to close at 1869. Pharmaceutical giant Pfizer dosed up 4%. It wants to buy London-based pharma company AstraZeneca for nearly $100 billion. AstraZeneca flew up 14.3% on the news. A bad day for some internet and social media stocks. Facebook fell 2.25%. Netflix rolled down 2.5%. And Twitter tweeted 2% lower. Online retail giant Amazon dropped off 2.4%. But Apple was up almost 4%. In communication stocks, Verizon trilled up 1.4%. 3M rang up 0.5%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.70%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Federal Reserve begins a two-day meeting on interest rates. It's one of eight scheduled over the course of the year. The Conference Board releases its April Consumer Confidence Index. And 46 years ago, in the age of Aquarius, hair opened on Broadway. Let the sun shine in. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. Here's the good news. High school graduation rates are at historic highs. 80% of high school students now graduate. The bad news? 20% of students still do not get that diploma. The numbers come from Education Department statistics from 2012, and they were presented today at a big education summit here in Washington. So what's changed? Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
In 2001, 71% of American teenagers graduated from high school. Today, it's a little over 80%. So what changed? One, better data, so people are more aware of the problem. Two, the accountability movement. Think No Child Left Behind. And when folks started digging through the data so they could be more accountable, they found just 12% of high schools produced 50% of the dropouts. John Bridgeland, one of the principal authors of today's report, says some of those dropout factories are now gone.
But many of them were retooled or redesigned. And in New York City, for example, they took large urban schools and transformed them into many smaller learning environments.
With smaller classrooms and more one-on-one attention, some states have done particularly well. North Carolina went from a 68% graduation rate in 2005 to over 82% today. Jim Key, area superintendent for high schools in Durham, says his district now starts tracking kids who are potential dropouts in middle school. Then they send them to ninth grade a few weeks early.
That gives them a chance to become more acclimated to high school, to build some positive relationships with a few teachers. It just gives those students, I guess, a leg up, if you will, on being prepared for high school and understanding the expectations and what's at stake.
And what's at stake, says John Bridgeland, is earning power.
In economic terms, a high school graduate will make $1 million more over his or her lifetime than a high school dropout.
College grads, of course, do even better. But the latest stats show that fewer high school grads are applying to college. Less than two-thirds of the class of 2013 attended college in the fall. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
In the near term, immigration reform seems unlikely. There's still an impasse here in Washington. But the patterns of illegal immigration to the U.S. have been shifting. fewer migrants are trying to sneak across Arizona's border these days. And that means some towns on the Mexican side, towns that rely on the smuggling economy, are being hit hard. From the Fronteras desk at KJZZ in Phoenix, Jude Joffe Block reports.
On a recent rainy afternoon, I drove down a dirt road in the town of Altar in northern Mexico. My guide was Padre Prisciliano Peraza. He's been the priest here for a decade, a period in which this small smuggling town boomed and now appears on the verge of a bust. Peraza says this dirt road leads to the border town of Sasabe, 60 miles away. This route drove Altar's growth. Local businesses sprouted up to feed, house, and sell supplies to migrants heading up to the Arizona border, including van companies to drive them on this very road. He says the vans are old, with the seats removed to crowd in more passengers. Much of this business is controlled by organized crime. But fewer migrants are making the harrowing trek across the border these days. Many who are crossing are going farther east to Texas's Rio Grande Valley. Pharmacist Maria Jaime Pena has been selling migrants bestsellers like caffeine pills and electrolyte packets for years.
Before, many more people used to come through here.
The local government estimates that 4 years ago, several thousand migrants passed by here a day. Now, a couple hundred.
There's a lot of Central Americans, and I've seen some women coming with their babies.
About two-thirds of Altar's restaurants and half the convenience stores have closed in the last 4 years, according to the local government. Still, Jaime Peña's store shows some evidence of a migrant economy, like the gallon-size jet-black water jugs that sell for about a dollar.
Before, migrants used the clear water bottles, but since they're out there hidden, they said the moonlight reflected on the bottle.
Those reflections made it easier for Border Patrol to spot migrants in the desert. So voila, a business opportunity was born.
They came out with a black gallon bottle, and that's what migrants take with them.
But now that bottling company says it's had to diversify its clientele. On the outskirts of Altar, local families gather to celebrate a quinceañera while it pours rain outside. Many here are worried about the town's future. Juan Jose Corona Moreno is a doctor.
It's as if we're waiting adrift for something miraculous to happen. And really, if we as citizens don't do something, this isn't going to change.
Corona Moreno thinks the town should return to its ranching and farming roots. The local government is trying to recruit a manufacturing plant. That could be this town's only shot at new jobs, unless another wave of migration picks up. In Altar, Mexico, I'm Jude Joffe Block for Marketplace.
It's been 10 years since Dove, the soap brand owned by Unilever, launched its Real Beauty campaign. That got attention because it used, quote-unquote, real women in its ads. Well, a decade later, a new Dove ad is getting attention too, but not for the same reasons. It puts real women through a fake clinical trial for a beauty product to show them that their actual beauty lies inside. But that campaign has backfired. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains why.
I woke up this morning feeling really refreshed.
I think I feel more confident.
In Dove's new video, women feel better about themselves after using this super-duper scientific new beauty patch. Only, turns out the patch is a placebo, a fake. Then this real psychologist turns out to be running an experiment on the women.
There's nothing in the beauty patch?
Nothing.
Moment of self-realization. Feeling beautiful makes you beautiful.
That's awesome.
Only it's not awesome, at least not for Dove, because critics have called this video patronizing and badvertising and Dove making these women seem dumb. There's a storm of blogs and Facebook posts.
It kind of creeped me out right from the beginning.
That's Andrea Learned, author of Don't Think Pink, a book about marketing to women. She says Dove's original Real Beauty campaign turned selling soap into a cultural dialogue, helping women embrace their bodies, old or young, thin or fat. But this is a huge misstep.
Get out of digging this hole for women as being these incredibly insecure beings. I think that is old news.
That theme of women's insecurity has inspired a parody video that's gone viral, in which the women in the experiment look in the mirror and see a gorilla.
Do you feel unattractive? I bet you do.
No, I don't. That's a man in a gorilla suit.
Animal in the room! I want to leave, please. I don't want the $25.
It's pretty cutting. Former ad exec, now consultant, Cindy Gallup, agrees the new Dove campaign is bad. But she also thinks any publicity can be good publicity.
The fact that we are talking about this in whatever context is terrific, and it's all tremendous fodder to actually take the campaign forward in an even stronger way next time out of the gate.
I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, you know that in Washington, D.C., we like politics. What may surprise you is how much we love pandas. The National Zoo is home to my favorite, Rusty the red panda, and there's always a long line to see Bao Bao the baby giant panda. We have, I kid you not, panda-related press conferences. Well, enough, the Washington City paper says. You've heard of peak beard? Well, we've hit peak panda. Why? The city paper points to an email sent to donors this morning advertising a $6,000 VIP Bao Bao tour package that'll get you a behind-the-scenes tour on which you'll get to meet the big guy himself, 5 valet parking passes, and admission to a cocktail reception. For $6,000, I hope it's a stiff drink. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow climbed 87 points, 0.5%. The NASDAQ fell 1 point, basically flat. And the S&P 500 rose 6 points, 0.3%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, Millie Jefferson, Melissa Yeager-Miller. I'm David Gura. We hope to meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.